Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a man who arguably was one of the greatest artists in the history of the blues. His name was Chester Arthur Burnett. He was born in Mississippi in 1910, and he was indeed named after the president, Chester Arthur. Probably most people will not know him by that name, Chester Arthur Burnett. They will know him by the name under which he performed, and that was Howlin' Wolf. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a bit about the life and music of Howlin' Wolf. And our guest for the show is James Segrest. He is one of the authors of a recently published biography, which is entitled Moanin' at Midnight, and the book takes its title from the title of one of Howlin' Wolf's songs. The subtitle is The Life and Times of Howlin' Wolf. It's published by Pantheon. It's out in the bookstores now. James Segrest has written for Blues Access magazine and also co-wrote the liner notes for the Grammy-nominated album, A Tribute to Howlin' Wolf. His co-author on the book, by the way, is Mark Hoffman, who has also written for Blues Access as well as other publications and narrated the prize-winning film, The Howlin' Wolf Story. So if you're interested in finding out more about Howlin' Wolf, you can definitely head out to the bookstore and look at the book. And we'll play you some music this morning. If you're completely unfamiliar with his music and his voice, we'll give you a little taste of that. And also, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILO. Mr. Segrest, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, you know, just any time I can talk about the wolf is a good time for me.
Right. Well, we're glad to be able to do something for us a little out of the ordinary. Most of the time we're talking about things like politics and history and social issues, and every once in a while it's good for us to break the mold a little bit and do something really different, talk about popular culture. So I'm really pleased that you could do it. I think probably it seems like almost everything I read about him, almost everything begins by talking about his physical presence and what sort of a force of nature he seemed to be when he was on stage performing. So give us a description. What was Howlin' Wolf like, particularly when he was on stage?
Well, I mean, you know, Wolf was just a total wild man when he was on the stage. He was liable to do anything at any time. Wolf was certainly the most dynamic performer in the history of the blues in terms of a live performer. I mean, he had this really incredible voice. It's really hard to describe his voice. It wasn't just deep and gravelly. It just had a weight to it that most voices don't have. And Wolf was a very large man. He was like 6'3", 275 pounds in his prime. He had these huge hands, these huge feet. He wore size 16 shoes and the most massive head I've ever seen on a human being. So, I mean, Wolf was just an incredible physical specimen. And when you match that with this voice and then this really outrageous style he had on stage where he would do all sorts of things, like he would get down on the floor and he would crawl around. He would play the guitar behind his head. He would get up and shake his massive hips and roll his eyes, and sometimes he would do things with the microphone that you're really not supposed to do on stage. And so, you know, he was just really this over-the-top performer.
Yeah, all the kinds of things that we're sort of used to now, or at least people after that have done. I don't know if you'd say he did it before anybody else, but he maybe earlier than a lot of other people was doing that kind of stuff.
Well, I think he was one of the ones who really inspired a lot of the rock and roll performers to be so over the top. I mean, Wolf was there in West Memphis, Arkansas, at the same time that rock and roll was going to be born across the river in Memphis. And he first recorded for Sam Phillips, the same man who first recorded, of course, Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and Carl Perkins and Johnny Cash. And so, you know, I think that a lot of his really wild performance style and the energy he brought to stage, I think it did get translated into rock and roll. And then, of course, when he went to England in 1964 as a part of the American Folk Blues Festival tour, he played shows in Germany and France and England. And a lot of the British rock and rollers that were mainly into the blues at that time before they really switched more over to rock and roll, a lot of them actually saw him perform live at that time. And I think he really inspired them to a great deal. And I think it was not just his voice and his music, which they already knew from records, but I think the first time that they actually saw him on stage, I think it completely blew some of them away, because they had never seen another performer who was so dynamic and so outrageous on stage. I mean, many of them had seen other blues performers that had come over before then, but most of them would either just sit down on stage on a chair and play the guitar, or if they were standing up, you know, they would just play the guitar and sing. I mean, they wouldn't do all these, like, over-the-top things. So I do think that Wolf helped to inspire a lot of the stuff that has come since, and, you know, and like people like Prince and other modern performers have, you know, have taken it on to, you know, they've taken it on further.
Yeah. And he was, as you say, he was another one of these performers, blues, American blues performers, that really excited particularly the British rockers, guys like Eric Clapton and the Rolling Stones and people like that, who were really interested in American music and then took that and kind of put their own spin on it and interestingly enough, reintroduced it to the United States and probably brought performers like this and their music to the attention of Americans who really didn't know about them, didn't follow them. And it's sort of ironic that it took the music to have been exported and then brought back for a lot of Americans. I mean, that's not to say there weren't Americans who were interested in blues and knew about blues, because there were. But the level of popularity I think the blues enjoyed after that had a lot to do with the fact that these British musicians were saying to Americans, hey, this is your music. This is great music. You shouldn't be ignoring it. You should be hearing it, and you should be honoring and acknowledging these performers. This is your American roots music, and you ought to know about it.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that's one of the best things you can say about the British blues performers, like the Stones and Clapton and the Animals and people like that. Is one thing about them is that they never try to disguise where the music came from. I mean, you know, clearly on all their records, they would clearly state, you know, who wrote the song. And when people would interview them, they would say, well, you know, if you like our version of this song, you ought to go back and listen to the original by, say, Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters or whoever else it may have been. So they were really great about that. And what they did was they helped to really bring in the young white audience for the blues. Up until then, blues had been very popular, of course, in the black community for many years. I mean, back in the 20s and 30s, I mean, blues was really the black popular music. And it continued to a large extent that way on up until the 50s, when you had kind of like more like R&B was taking over, although blues was still very popular in the 50s. But by the early 1960s, with the coming of soul music, blues was starting to die off to a certain extent in the black community. So it was really great timing that this new audience of young white blues fans came in, because it kept a lot of the bluesmen going.
Yeah. Well, I have a caller here I want to get to, but I tell you, you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that it's difficult to describe his voice. So we'll play some, and so people can hear what we're talking about. Why don't we get our cut set up. We'll figure out what we want to play, and then we can talk with the caller, and then we'll get to the music. So what is there something you'd like to suggest to play as a first offering here?
Well, you know, I think we could even start out maybe with Wolf's very first hit and the song that gave the title to our book, Moaning at Midnight.
Okay.
It starts off with this just really, I mean, just a totally amazing, unearthly moan at the start. And the first time I ever heard this record, it was hard to believe that this could be coming from a human being.
Yeah, that's a great tune. Well, we'll get that ready to go, and rather than make the caller wait, let's go ahead and talk with this first caller.
Okay.
And in Indiana, on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello. This takes me back to the mid-50s in high school. I started listening to Gallatin, Tennessee radio station. I think it started at midnight. In fact, the program was something like Beer Barrels and Boogie or something like that. It went on, I think, to 3. Got a lot of hassles from my parents, of course, and that's where I found out about Howlin' Wolf. And just in particular, I remember his song Chicken and the Hawk, which caused me to have a problem in the high school system, because I was the one who bought records for the dances on the weekends after basketball games and football games, And I introduced my hometown to Howlin' Wolf and some other blues people, and I purchased these records on 45 from a larger town next to us, which had a very small black population. So I don't know if they had the 45s because of that, or whether the man that ran the store was really understood what was going on in music. I just wondered, in your studies of Howlin' Wolf, if you ever come across who the person was, the disc jockey, who had that Gallatin, Tennessee radio station by any chance. And I'll hop off and listen to Moanin' again, because it'll take me back a long time. And it was awfully, awfully influential. From there, I went into jazz and to the mainstream, I guess. Yeah, Miles Davis and et cetera. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Good program.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know what? I'm not exactly sure who the Gallatin disc jockey was, but there were a lot of really pioneer white disc jockeys in the South that were playing black music. I mean, they weren't just playing black music. Really, music at that time wasn't nearly as segregated on the radio as it is today, ironically. I mean, you had people like Dewey Phillips in Memphis, who was a famous disc jockey and who was one of the ones who really helped to break a lot of the first records that Elvis put out there in Memphis. And he would play, like, rockabilly records and country records and R&B records and blues records. He would mix it all together. And then also in Tennessee, there was a famous disc jockey named John R. His name was John Richborg, but they just called him John R. And then there was Hoss Allen. And I'm trying to think of the call letters for their station, and it's jumping out of my head right now. But anyway, they had very popular programs, and most of these were like late at night, like he would say, you know, like maybe after midnight. And there were certainly a lot of young white teenagers in the rural South in that area of the country that were surreptitiously tuning in these stations late at night, you know, often up under the covers or something, and listening to these really amazing records. And all of these disc jockeys would, like, advertise places where you could, like, purchase these records wholesale. And, this was certainly one way that a lot of these records broke into the white community. So really, even before the 1960s, there was starting to be a certain groundswell for blues among certain white listeners. But it really was the British invasion that put it over the top.
Well, we're talking in this part of Focus 580 with James Segrest. He's the co-author, along with Mark Hoffman, of the first full-length biography ever published of the blues great Howlin' Wolf. And the book is titled Moanin' at Midnight. It's published by Pantheon, and it's out now in the bookstores. So without further ado here, for that last caller and for anybody else who's not familiar with Howlin' Wolf, let's play the tune. This is the tune Moanin' at Midnight. Telephone. that is, Moanin' at Midnight. It was recorded in Memphis in 1951, produced by Sam Phillips, and Howlin' Wolf is singing, and he's also playing the harmonica on that, right?
Yes. Yeah, you know, Wolf was a really great harmonica player. I think he's often kind of, I think that's often kind of overlooked because Wolf had such an amazing voice. I think it would overshadow anything else that he might have done. But Wolf was really a great harp player, as they call it in blues circles. They always refer to it as a blues harp. So, you know, I think that was one of the better examples of Wolf's harp playing there. Wolf got this really massive tone, you know, when he played the harp. He wasn't a really flashy harp player, say like a little Walter Jacobs or a Sonny Boy Williamson or somebody like that. But he would get this really massive tone, and he had a great sense of rhythm with his harmonica playing.
Yeah, and you can certainly, the power of his voice comes through pretty strongly. There, the other cuts maybe where it comes through more strongly, but there you can get the sense. One of the quotes about his voice that I really like, and I don't remember who it was who said it, but somebody said his voice sounded like 40 acres of crushed garlic.
That was Ronnie Hawkins. Ronnie Hawkins was a famous early rockabilly singer. He's probably best known because his backing band eventually left him and became the group known as The Band. And that was his group before they broke off and became their own group by themselves.
Yeah.
And of course, Robbie Robertson and Lee Von Helm and all the guys in the band, they were heavily influenced by Wolf's records.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about his childhood, because it seems that his growing up seems to be the archetypal bluesman childhood, you know, hard scrabble life in Mississippi, and someone who was inspired by and learned from on one of the great Mississippi Delta bluesmen, Charlie Patton, who happened to be a neighbor, I guess, where it was that Howlin' Wolf grew up.
Well, Wolf was born in a little place called White Station, Mississippi, which is just outside of West Point, Mississippi. And this is over in the eastern part of the state. This is all the way almost over to the Alabama border. And this was probably, at the time, the most racist part of Mississippi. The black population was not that large, but the white population there was clearly wanting to keep them down. So he grew up in a very racist area in a very racist time. And then, you know, plus just being black in a place where it wasn't good to be black, Wolf also had a very difficult childhood. Wolf's mother and father broke up when he was just a small child. We were never exactly able to determine why they broke up. But his father moved to the Delta, and Wolf stayed with his mother. And Wolf's mother was a very strange woman. From everything we were able to find out about her, she was a very religious woman, but her religiosity took this kind of this strange form. And when Wolf was just a child, she put him out. She literally kicked him out of the house, and we were never exactly able to determine why she did that. We heard several different reasons, and in the book we discuss or mention all the different reasons we heard, and we were never able to find out which was the one. But anyway, she literally put Wolf out when he was just a small child, and he walked many miles with burlap sacks wrapped around his feet until he got to a great uncle's house, a man named Will Young. And Will Young took him in, but you know, this wasn't really charity, because Will Young worked Wolf the whole time that he'd stayed there with him, almost like he was a farm animal, and really mistreated him very badly. I mean, things like he wouldn't even let Wolf sit down at the table with the rest of the family when they would eat dinner. And he would often use like a bullwhip or something when he would discipline Wolf. So Wolf had this really horrendous childhood. And when he was around 13, he accidentally, I say accidentally, he may have kind of intentionally did it. But the story is he accidentally killed his uncle's prize hog. And this hog was worth several hundred dollars, and he knew that there was going to be all sorts of trouble for this, so he literally had to flee for his life, and he hopped a train when he was 13, and that's what took him eventually over to the Delta, and it was in the Delta that he was able to reunite with his father, a man named Doc Burnett, and Wolf and his father were very close, So now at last, Wolf had more of a stable family life. And it was there when he was living in the Delta, just outside of a place called Rouville, Mississippi. He was living on this plantation known as the Young and Morrow Plantation. And just a few miles away, there was a larger plantation known as Dockery's Plantation. And on Dockery's Plantation lived the most famous and the most important of the early Delta blues singers, a man named Charlie Patton. And the first time Wolf saw Charlie, he was like 18 years old. And it was just like this amazing experience for him. As soon as he saw Charlie Patton, he knew exactly what he wanted to do for the rest of his life. He wanted to be a famous bluesman like Charlie Patton. And I think I should probably describe Charlie Patton a little bit for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Patton was this really unusual-looking man. He was of mixed ancestry. And he was light-skinned. He was short. He was small. He probably only weighed about 125, 130 pounds. He had these big ears that stuck out on the side of his head and wavy hair. So, you know, he was this really unusual-looking guy. Wolf described him on more than one occasion as either looking like a Mexican or like a Puerto Rican or an Indian. So, you know, he didn't look like your typical black blues singer. And then even at this age, Wolf was already very tall, and, you know, he wasn't near as heavy at this age as he would be later. But Wolf was this tall, dark-skinned black man, and here he is suddenly starting to pal around with Charlie Patton. And Charlie Patton literally taught Wolf how to play the guitar. And another thing that Wolf learned from Charlie, in addition to just how to play the guitar, was Charlie was this really amazing performer. And this is where Wolf got a lot of his ideas about how to be a blues musician. Charlie would do all sorts of crazy things. When he would play the guitar, he would play the guitar behind his head, or he would stick it between his legs and ride it like it was a pony while still playing it. He would throw it up in the air and spin it around two or three times and catch it while still keeping the beat during the song. So Charlie was this really outrageous, over-the-top performer. And Charlie also had a really heavy, thick voice that he used when he sang. If you listen to some of Charlie's records, which are really hard to listen to because they came out on a label named Paramount, and Paramount was kind of a cheap label, and the quality of material they used to actually make the records was not the best, so the sound quality hasn't maintained that well. But if you listen to his records, they're really hard to understand, but you can still get the real power of his voice. But the difference is that the voice that Charlie used on a record was kind of a voice that he put on. That wasn't his natural voice. He would kind of deliberately sing in this rough, hoarse, husky style. Whereas Wolf, when you hear him on record, that's exactly Wolf's voice. The way he sounds on record is the way he sounded when he would just talk. Wolf had this really deep, gravelly voice that he was blessed with.
Well, we're going to go on and talk with another caller here in a minute. We're already at the midpoint. Our guest is James Segrist. He's the co-author of a new, recently published biography of the blues musician Howlin' Wolf. The title of the book is Moanin' at Midnight. It's published by Pantheon. Maybe before we should decide on what our next musical selection might be so we get that ready to go. Is there something at this point you think you might like to suggest we play?
Well, you know, I would like to hear myself my all-time favorite song by Howlin' Wolf. And this is really the song that inspired me to write this book. The first time I heard Howlin' Wolf was in the mid-1980s. I'd never heard of him before then. And I just went to my local record store, and I wasn't liking what I was hearing on the radio, so I was looking through the record bins, and I noticed the blues section. I'd never bought a blues record. And just some of the names intrigued me, you know, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Sonny Boy Williamson. You know, these names were just so colorful. So I bought an album that had Howlin' Wolf on it. It was a live album. It didn't have this song on it, but it had a couple other live songs by. And the first time I heard his voice, I was just totally blown away. So I ran back to my record store like the next day, and I bought another album, and this was Howlin' Wolf's greatest hits. And this particular song that I want you to play is on there. And it's a song called Smokestack Lightning.
All right.
The first time I heard this song, literally the hair stood up on the back of my neck. And really, every time I hear it, and I've probably listened to this song I don't know how many thousands of times since then, I still have the same reaction. It's just the most amazing song I've ever heard.
Okay. Well, we'll get that ready to go. We'll talk with a caller here in a second. One thing, too, I just need to remind people who are listening, has to do with the weather. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of northern Illinois that will be in effect until 3 o'clock this afternoon. There's possibility of hail, thunderstorm winds, and dangerous lightning. And in our severe weather coverage area, this includes Ford County. And I guess there is some possibility that here in our area in Champaign-Urbana, we might have a passing shower or thunderstorm this afternoon, but I don't think we're expecting any severe weather here in our immediate area. However, we'll keep you up to date on what's going on with the weather, and we'll have our next weather broadcast as part of the Afternoon Magazine 1235. So again, this is a severe thunderstorm watch. Ford County is included, will be in effect until 3 o'clock this afternoon. And again, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with James Segrest, talking about Howlin' Wolf. We have a caller here in Champaign, so why don't we talk with them before we have some more music. Here's a caller, line one. Hello.
Morning. I'm enjoying the program, and I certainly enjoy Howlin' Wolf and learning more about him. I'm really calling in response to the first caller, his reference to Gallatin, Tennessee. I used to listen to John R. and Hoss Allen back in the 50s on WLAC in Nashville, and they advertised a record shop in Gallatin, Tennessee. I think it was Randy's Records. And they used to have specials advertising all kind of blues and gospel and things like that. But I'm wondering if that's perhaps what he's referring to, the Randy's Records in Gallatin, Tennessee.
Yes, I'm sure that's it. You know, as soon as you said that, you know, everything clicked in my head. You're exactly right. I'm sure that's who he was referring to.
Okay, well, that's all I had.
All right, well,
thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you.
And other folks who are listening, if you have questions, you want to call in 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, why don't we go ahead and play Smokestack Lightning?
Ooh.
Smokestack Lightning. That was recorded in 1956 at the Chess Studios in Chicago. And again, Helen Wolf singing and playing harmonica. Willie Dixon plays bass on that, and some people might know that name. How is it that that he ended up in Chicago, going from Memphis to Chicago?
Well, the way it happened was Sam Phillips at the time had not started his own record company. He was like an independent producer. He had his Memphis recording service there in Memphis, and he would, like, record different artists that he thought had some sort of potential, and then he would, like, sell the records to various people. And one of the record companies that he was, like, selling records to was Chess Records. You know, it's kind of an interesting story. At the time, he was also, like, selling records to the Bahari Brothers, who were out in California and who had this label known as Modern. And when the Bahari Brothers found out that Sam had sent Howlin' Wolf's record to Chess instead of to them, they were pretty upset. So they had Ike Turner, who was their talent scout there in the Delta, to quickly help arrange a session with Wolf. So then they also started recording Wolf, and they released records by Wolf on their label RPM. So here you had Wolf in the early 1950s. He was recording there with Sam Phillips in Memphis for records that were ending up on Chess. Well, at the same time, across the river in West Memphis, he was recording records that were being released on the RPM label out of California. So then there was this real big dispute that went back and forth between the two until it was finally settled, and Chess ended up with Wolf. And then in the early 1950s, about 1953, Leonard wanted Wolf to come on up to Chess, because Chess by that time were doing most of their own recording there in Chicago. And they wanted Wolf, who was one of their hottest properties at the time. He was having numerous hit records on the R&B charts at the time. They wanted him to come on up to Chicago. So that's when Wolf moved to Chicago. And then, of course, it was in Chicago that Wolf recorded almost all of his best-known songs. And many of them were written by Willie Dixon, who you mentioned a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. He's an author of a lot of songs that maybe people will recognize. They may recognize them in those versions that some of those British guys have done, but he was the guy who was responsible for a lot of those tunes.
Yes, you know, I think a song you might want to play in connection to that would be The Red Rooster. A lot of people, of course, know this from the Rolling Stone version. They did it as Little Red Rooster, mm-hmm. and had a big hit with it in the early 1960s. And then also the famous soul singer Sam Cooke did a version of it that was a hit also. So it was a hit both as a blues record, it's kind of a blues-slash-rock-and-roll record, and also as a blues-slash-soul record. So it's one of those songs that's crossed over a lot of different ways. So if you get a chance, you may want to play that song this morning.
Yeah, okay, we can find that. And you're thinking about his version and not that one that he did in the 70s with the British guys.
Yes, the version from the early 1960s is the best version.
Right.
Okay. Although I must admit the version with Eric Clapton and the Stones is a great version too, but I still prefer the early 60s version. And this song is actually one of the few examples of Wolf's guitar playing on record. Wolf is playing the slide guitar on this song. So whenever you hear this slide sound, that's Wolf playing. He's playing a slide, while Hubert Sumlin, who was his ace guitar player by that time, is playing the other guitar part.
Okay. Well, let's hear that. We got that ready to go.
I have a little red rooster
That's Red Rooster. When was that recorded?
I think that was in 1961, I think.
Okay.
I think that was the year. Either 1960 or 1961. Sometimes these dates, yeah.
Yeah, 1961. And that was also at Chess Studios in Chicago.
Yes. Yes, and that was a song that was written by Willie Dixon. Although I think Wolf was doing earlier versions of the song long before then. I interviewed one of Wolf's stepsisters, and she told me that Wolf was doing a version of the Red Rooster all the way back in the 30s. So I think oftentimes when you see with some of the songs that are credited to Willie Dixon, they're often kind of a collaboration, really, between Willie and Wolf, and I think this is one of the examples of that, although some of the songs were clearly totally written by Willie Dixon. And Willie's great talent as a songwriter for Wolf was he knew how to write songs that had a hook in them. He knew how to write a hit song. He knew how to write a song that would, like, stick in your mind. And Willie's other great talent was he knew how to, like, tailor a song to a specific performer. Like, you know, he wouldn't give Muddy Waters the same type of song that he would give Willie Dixon. And he wouldn't give Little Walter the same type of, the same type of song he would give Howlin' Wolf.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't give Little Walter the same type of song he would give Howlin' Wolf. You know, he knew what would work with each of those artists. And that's what made him so valuable there at Chess and why he wrote so many of the songs that have become most identified with these artists.
One of the stories that we see often with performers like Howlin' Wolf and others of his contemporaries is that the people who ended up making the money were the ones who pressed the records and distributed them. And often performers were not rewarded anywhere nearly as much money as the people who ran the companies. And you talked about this long relationship that he had with Chess and the fact that he did some of his best work for Chess. What was his relationship with the company like?
Wolf's relationship with the company was pretty much strictly business. Wolf saw Chess Records as just a place that he went and he kind of like did his job. This was very different from example, for example, from, say, Muddy Waters' relationship with Leonard Chess, who was the head of Chess Records. Muddy and Leonard had a very close relationship, although it was a very paternalistic relationship. It was almost like the same relationship that black sharecroppers had with the plantation owner down south. Muddy kind of played that same role in his relationship with Leonard. I mean, Muddy kind of played the sharecropper role, and Leonard was like the plantation boss. And Muddy knew how to work that relationship to his advantage. So you know, Muddy would get Leonard like to buy him a new Cadillac, or buy him like really expensive jewelry and stuff. Muddy was a very flashy guy. Wolf's relationship was totally different. Although Wolf had grown up on the same plantations that Muddy had, he had a different mindset. He just saw Chess Records as a place that he went and he did his job. And he didn't want Leonard Chess to buy him a new Cadillac every year or anything like that. He just wanted to be paid his money, because that's what Leonard would do. Like with Muddy, he would like buy him a new Cadillac and then he would take it out of his royalties. And, you know, Wolf said, you know, just pay me my money. So Wolf's relationship was very different in that respect. And he never really had a close personal relationship with Leonard Chess or with Phil Chess, Leonard's younger brother, who was also very important in the company. So, you know, they had a very different relationship in that respect, but it was a very good relationship in terms of the work that they did. Because, I mean, no one can argue with the records that they put out on Wolf. you know, it's pretty clear that Leonard knew something about how to make a hit record.
One of the things, this interesting story is about Wolf, that it goes to the business side of things, that was that he actually looked after the long-term interest of the men who were in his band and actually took Social Security out of of their paychecks.
Exactly. I mean, this was totally unheard of at the time, and it's still unheard of today. I don't think there's probably any Chicago blues band that does this today. Wolf was actually taking out Social Security and unemployment on the guys in his band. By at least by the early 1960s, he was doing this. Wolf always looked ahead. Wolf was not the type of guy who liked to look backwards. He always liked to look at the present or look at the future. So he was always thinking ahead. And he knew that these guys were eventually going to get old. These guys in his band were going to eventually get old and not be able to play anymore, and they were going to need something to fall back on. So I think this was something that you can really say to Wolf's credit, that you know, that he would go to all the trouble of taking out this money on the guys, because it wasn't that easy a thing to do. They had to hire an accountant and everything to set this up. And the accountant showed Wolf's wife, Lily Burnett, how to do a lot of this, and so she helped Wolf with a lot of this in terms of the managing the band's finances and things.
Well, it's interesting if you because you went out and you talked to a lot of people who played with him and who knew him and who were perhaps influenced by him, and that you get these two images of the man that some people say things that are pretty insulting about his not being very sophisticated or not being very smart, and then other people say, no, that's not different. I mean, it's true he might not have had a lot of formal education, but he was not a dumb man. And he was actually a very savvy guy, and really, in a lot of ways, very sophisticated. Which of those is there some way in which both of those kind of pictures of him are true?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it just depends on the point of view of the person that you're talking to, and how close a relationship they had with Wolf. I think the casual person that met Wolf might come across with this idea that he was not very bright. For one thing, Wolf was a very quiet guy, surprisingly enough, off stage. He was not a big talker. He kind of kept to himself. He was kind of a loner to a certain extent. And I think a lot of this goes back to his really troubled childhood. Wolf had a hard time trusting people. And Wolf really had to get to know somebody before he would kind of open up and really show this other side of himself. So I think a lot of the people who just maybe knew Wolf more from a business relationship, you know, maybe people there at the studio or people, say, some of the people out at the clubs and things that really weren't in the band or who weren't really that close to Wolf, they wouldn't have seen this other side of Wolf, which was a very thoughtful man, a very considerate man, a very kind man. One of the producers there at Chess, Ralph Bass, he told me that, you know, that Wolf was this really unusual guy. He said on the outside he would be, you know, real grr, you know, you don't want to mess with me, you know, I'm a really bad guy, don't come around me. But he said once you got to know Wolf, that he was totally different on the inside. He said he was like a big marshmallow on the inside. And Wolf was a very intelligent man, but he wasn't an educated man. One person I asked about this was Sam Phillips when I interviewed him in Memphis, because I said, you know, some people say that Wolf wasn't very smart. And Sam Phillips got mad at me as soon as I asked that question. He said, bullshit was what he said. he said, no way, no how. He said, Wolf was a very smart man. And he said that the reason he thinks a lot of people may have thought that about Wolf was, he said, because Wolf was not the type, like, you would be having a conversation with Wolf, and you would be doing all the talking. Wolf wouldn't say much. But he said that was because Wolf wanted to think about it before he would answer. And he said, you know, later on he might come back and tell you something or say something to you. You know, Wolf wanted to sit down and think about it. He wasn't the type that would, like, just say things off the cuff or off the top of his head. He would, like, kind of study on them and think about them. But Wolf was very aware that he lacked education. And one of the things that I most admire about Wolf is that later in his life, even after he had had many hit records and was a big success, Wolf was going back to night school there in Chicago. He was learning to read and write and do simple arithmetic. And he got up to about a 6th or 7th grade education, which was really amazing because as a child he got absolutely no education.
He gave his last performance in 1975, and at that time, I think, for a number of years, had not been in good health, mm-hmm. although continued to do some recording, continued to do some performing. So it seemed like he was somebody that was really, really driven to perform as long as he possibly could.
Yes, exactly. I think if Wolf could have died on stage, I think he would have been happy to have gone out that way. He literally pushed his body up until he couldn't go any further. Wolf had several heart attacks in the early 1970s, and he also developed bad kidneys, and he had to have kidney dialysis for the last several years of his life. His wife, Lily, even went and took lessons on how to do the dialysis. And he had a dialysis machine put into his basement at his home. And often, Lily would, like, hook him up to the machine in the morning. And dialysis machines then weren't as advanced as they are now. So a dialysis treatment would take about 6 hours or so. So here would be Wolf laying on a table hooked up to this dialysis machine for, like, 6 hours. And then maybe that same night he would go out to a club and perform. And the people at the club probably couldn't have told that he had been on a dialysis machine all that morning because he would be just this totally outrageous guy on stage. But, yes, he literally tried to die on stage. His most famous show that he did there at the end was at the Chicago Amphitheater. He was on a bill with B.B. King and I think Bobby Blue Bland and I forget who all else was on there. O.V. Wright was on there.
Yeah, Albert King?
Yes, and Albert King. And he just gave this totally over-the-top performance. I mean, he got down and crawled on the stage and did all these outrageous things that he had done years earlier. I think Wolf knew that this was going to be his last major performance. And when he got off stage, I mean, he was just totally exhausted. And when he went backstage, he literally collapsed. And they had to call the paramedics. And the paramedics came out there to get him, and but Wolf didn't even want to let the paramedics take him away. So literally, he tried to die on stage. It's a very heroic story how he struggled there at the end. And one of the songs that Wolf had recorded in the mid-1960s that became kind of an anthem of his, especially in this latter part of his life, he would do it at almost every one of his shows, was a song called Going Down Slow. And literally, Wolf was going down slow at the time. And it's really sad. When Wolf was in the hospital for the last time, he had Lily call his mother, who was living in Clarksdale, Mississippi. He wanted his mother to come up to Chicago to see him because he knew he was dying, and his mother refused to come up. And she didn't come up for his funeral either. So, you know, that was very sad. And I think often when he was saying this song, Going Down Slow, I think he would be thinking about his own mother, because in the song he says, you know, please write my mother, tell her the shape I'm in. And so I think that song had a lot of meaning.
Well, maybe we can play a little bit. I don't think we can play the whole thing, but let's do that.
Okay.
Man, you know I done enjoyed things that kings and queens will never have. In fact, kings and queens can't never get. And they don't even know about it. And good times.
Well, I'm afraid I really hate to start playing something and to fade it out. I think that kind of disrespects the music, but we kind of got to do that because we're here at the end of the time. There's certainly lots of Howlin' Wolf available on that's recorded. People want to hear the music, and they can look at the book. It's titled Moanin' at Midnight, The Life and Times of Howlin' Wolf, published by Pantheon by our guest, James Segrest. And thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Oh, well, I loved it. You know, I enjoy talking about the wolf, and I would encourage everybody, you know, whether they buy the book or not. Of course, I would like them to buy the book. But if you don't buy the book, at least go out and buy some Howlin' Wolf CDs. You'll love the music. He was just one of a kind.
All right. Thank you very much.